This is Martin Willis, and welcome to the Antique Auction Podcast Show. Today's show is an informative show. We hope you get something out of it. But we also have upcoming auction segments where we interview the auctioneer or staff of an auction house about an upcoming auction, get a little behind the scenes, and talk about the highlights of the sale. You can find those if you tune in on our website. Well, we hope you enjoy today's show, and thanks for listening. This is part two of decoys, and part one we had Gary Guyette from Guyette Schmidt, mostly talking about the high-end decoys. In this segment here, we're going to be talking mostly about mid-range, and our first phone guest, you may have listened to our podcast before, is John Ackerbloom from the state of Maine. He's a Civil War collector and also a decoy collector, and very knowledgeable in just about any subject that he delves into. So later on in the podcast, we will have a decoy carver, a renowned decoy carver, and his name is Mark McNair. He's down in Virginia. But right now, I'm going to introduce to you John Ackerbloom. Hi, John. How you doing?
Very good, Martin. How are you today?
Good. It's good to do this with you again in a whole different field. How long have you been? How long have you been into decoys?
I've been interested in decoys for a number of years. You know, actually, when we talked about my Civil War collection, that's 35 years old. Part of my interest in the Civil War and also in the decoys is because I enjoy hunting and fishing. I do and have, I won't say aggressively collected, but just accumulated small pieces in the hunting and sporting collectible field over the years, you know, such as guns or shell boxes or posters. So I had an interest in decoys, and, you know, early on I was a very casual, you know, one or two a year. Mm-hmm. But then when I exited my Civil War collection that I had accumulated for so many years and then sold, then in the early 2000 time period, I began to focus in on decoys a little bit more and actually purchasing in the core of what I collect right now.
So I would say you've had an interest in a long time, but just get a little more serious within the last 10 years.
Basically what happened is, you know, in the Civil War field, part of my genre that I collected there was musical instruments, and part of what's collectible musical instruments is the folk art, is the drums, the snare drums. You remember the Eagle drums. I watched you sell a couple over the years.
Yeah.
They're very folkative, very folk art. There's actually a crossover there to the antique field because of the painting,
right?
Because of the appeal of the colors, the early designs to it. And that's the same thing that applies to decoys. I always like the early designs, the folk art necessity of it. But I didn't actually go after collecting it until I'd actually freed up some money from selling part of my Civil War collection to then go into it. And part of it was, you know, I attended local auctions, you know that, and I would see these decoys come up on occasion at the local auctions, but I wouldn't know what I was doing. So I was somewhat hesitant to get involved and actually purchase a significant piece at that time. So I tended to back away from that. Once I decided that I want to get into the collecting, I had to set some parameters as to what I was going to do. But then I did the research, and then I became aware of what I was actually going to go after, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, so actually I know that you had mentioned to me that you do cataloging for an auction house other than Guyette and Schmidt. And you can go ahead and throw that out.
Yeah, you know, in decoy collecting, there are probably three or four principal auction houses that actually, that's pretty much all they do. Mm-hmm. One of them is a crossover sporting auction company, but the company that I worked with in the past was Amoskeg Auction Company, Jason Devine. I've known Jason for a number of years. He used to auction with his father, then split off, set up Amoskeg separately, and runs a fine organization there for many years. Does fine weapons, firearms, and sporting items. And we had actually played around with this idea, and then he had some decoys come in on consignment, and I had some pieces, so we put some pieces together. We put out the news, advertised a little bit, and so we had a decoy auction this past spring together, and I was actually working on a consulting basis with him and helping the cataloging.
So you had, in just kind of a short span of time, you've actually learned enough about decoys to actually catalog. So that's pretty impressive. How did you get your information?
Well, I applied my years of collecting in the Civil War area and adopted a lot of the same principles there. Mm-hmm. You know, in terms of how I'd inspect something, how I'd go about finding knowledge, looking at it. But I, you know, like we did in the Civil War collection, and I'll say here, the first thing I did is I accumulated a library. I currently have mm-hmm. like 200 volumes on certain decoys and stuff. Bought old auction catalogs. Gary Guyette in his comment made, you know, that in the early days, the books in the decoy field were the early catalogs.
Right. Was
the
it
Born auctions, Oliver's, those
Born?
Type of things.
Yeah.
Yep. And then what you tend to see if you study antique decoys and stuff, it was casual guys. It was the hunters that were interested, and it was casual. And then, you know, we had some early collections get broken up. There were some books on the field that were out there, but they tended to be general. And the specific books that the other collectors put together and published and released to the market were in the early 1980s. And when those books came out, it really allowed people to look at the whole field and specific species and carvers and began to figure it out. So what I did is I first adopted the books and read and looked at the different carvers. It's a pretty wide field, but once you start paying attention to paint, style of birds, painting techniques, feathering techniques, bill carvings, eye carvings, body types, there are regional specific carving types that fall into certain areas of the United States in terms of who did it. And then you're constantly narrowing it down as to known carvers. You're not always successful if you're presented with an unID'd mm-hmm. decoy. You're not always successful figuring out who the carver is. But
well, when Gary Guyette mentioned that he had a $350,000 unidentified shorebird at auction, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You're talking, it's kind of like artwork. Sometimes there is unidentified artwork, but the piece is so nice, it holds its own, and it's always the most important thing is what the item is, you know?
Right, and something like that, I mean, it brought that level of money based on its style, its look, its appeal, mm-hmm. the early characteristics that just, you know, you could see in the piece and just examining it.
Yeah, I'm sure the condition must have been really nice also.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what is your take, on condition of a decoy?
Well, I'd have to say here, Gary mentioned Decoy Magazine, which is one of the magazines out there. There's also Hunting and Fishing, Sporting Magazine. But in Decoy Magazine, they've done a number of interviews with some of the current and past few years collectors in the fields. And it's something that the magazine has always done over the years. But there's a resounding theme in a lot of those interviews, and it's always buy the best you can.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem that arises is you have to set some kind of financial level of involvement in how you're going to be in decoys, and then buy the best you can within that field. And by buying the best you can, it is a hobby. We are collecting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're swapping item sales and stuff. But it also is a business and a financial investment.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to figure out, by buying the best you can, if you're ever forced to resell it, trade it, or do whatever with it, the beauty there is you never have to explain the item. So
right.
As you go in a lower grade or something that has a little more restoration, then your ability to actually remarket the piece without making excuses for it are stressed a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So by buying the best you can, you never have to make an excuse. The item will stand on its own.
Yeah.
And that's the beauty of that. So by defining what you're going to collect and buying the best your own, you can do that. But as Gary said, there's the $300,000 level, but there's also an extremely active level at the lower end. They run a website, and a number of people run websites for decoys under $500.
Mm-hmm.
And they're pretty abundant if you want to look at it. But then the next level is, you know, like the $2,000 to $3,000 level, and then the $10,000 level, and the $15,000 and $25,000 and $35,000 level. So
mm-hmm.
you really have to set down all your parameters and then look at the field and figure out what you want to do for it, how you want to collect it, how you want to approach it. And that's what I did. And I'll just get into, I'll tell you what I did. I just looked at my financial position and my ability to invest and at what level I wanted to invest. Then I stepped back and I looked at the hobby of decoy collecting. And I somewhat got a little scientific. There were certain areas of items, that the folky pieces that I enjoyed, but I also realized that I didn't want to, I couldn't collect across the whole field. I couldn't invest in every carver from every region. decoys are basically divided up by region, by species, by type. You know, you can collect Susquehanna Flats. You can collect Chesapeake. You can collect North Shore, East Shore. can collect New Jersey. You can collect Northern Jersey, Long Island, Midwest, Factory Midwest. These are all genres of collecting. And you can go across the whole screen, you know, and only do known carvers, which a lot of the decoys are carved. That's the other thing with the old catalogs and stuff. Is decoys, much like certain other, we find new items entering the market every year, but they're not large in number. A lot of the decoys that are around right now have been around a number of years and have come out 20, 30 years ago. So new finds in this field do occur, but they're reduced in number and frequency versus the past.
When you say new finds, are you talking about new carvers or just new decoys?
I'm talking about the discovery of previously unknown decoys.
That's right.
Be it, yeah, not necessarily new carvers, but but just new types, new antique decoys, you know, fresh to the market.
I see. So what you're saying, basically, a lot of what you're saying, what you would see come up has been around already, and then there's fresh ones that come up in small numbers. Is that kind of what you're...
Yeah, just like any collecting field, the Civil War is the same, guns, maybe paintings. But some of the items have been around a number of years. They're just changing hands now.
Yeah.
There's a more frequency of the older collections getting broken up.
Right.
And, you know, that's always occurred over time. But now as the items are drifting, these higher-end decoys that are selling, the majority of them are ones that have been around for years. They're just moving from an old collection to a new collection. So when I approached the field, I just said, well, if I can't collect across the field, what am I going to collect? And I figured that I always liked the early style, so I picked the type of style. I picked the location, a locale in the United States where they were carved. I actually went right down to the species. Gary mentioned that a popular collecting field is the Mason Decoy Factory.
Right, Midwest.
Out of Michigan. Okay, some people collect all across Mason. What I did is I picked early factories, so there were a number of carvers. Mason, Hayes, Pratt, Dodge, and Peterson were early Midwest, Detroit, and Michigan carvers, and also outside of that area. And I picked blue-winged teal, which was a species of bird, a duck that was not as frequently carved as some of the other species. Like black ducks and mallards are pretty common because they're in all regions, whereas teal, green-winged and blue-winged teal, were more located in specific migration areas rather than across the whole United States. So there's a smaller number of decoys in that area. And so then I just picked early factory and I focused on early teal. They have an appeal. They're a very colorful bird. They're pretty in the house. My wife has absconded with a couple for the living room. you know, they sit right next to one of my painted military snare drums. So, you know, that's the folky and the crossover to the antique collecting side of it, too. Become a click phrase in the decoy area, and also it existed in some early military that, you know, it's a folky collecting, it's an antique collecting, so that the interest now has widened a little bit over the past few years to other collectors.
So getting back to what you were talking about earlier, and I agree with many aspects of the business, and I mentioned it in the magazine, was collect the very best. And what I tell, when people ask me advice for collecting, say for paintings, I would say, look, you're better off taking the money that you have and buying one really nice painting rather than 10 so-so paintings. Is that kind of the same thing in decoys?
I agree, but the problem is, and I think you would recognize this and most listeners would recognize this, is that anybody who collects is, quote, a collector, sound the same way. You know, by getting into little areas, you like to have a cross-section of items to display. Mm-hmm. So sometimes, even in my field that I collected, be it Civil War or decoys, I would invest in a lower-grade bird if I wanted to fill a specific hole in my collection. And
sure.
I'll enjoy that piece till I hopefully upgrade it in the future with a better one.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
you're right. You're better off with a few pieces than numerous ones. But if financially you can afford it, there are guys who aggressively go after the middle and higher end and, you know,
mm-hmm.
look to collect across the whole field. I can't do that, so I go for the best pieces within the area that I'm focusing on.
You know, I was kind of surprised to hear when Gary and I did that interview that decoy collecting hasn't been around really that long, you know?
Well, it hasn't. It hasn't. The guys who are the long-timers in the field, yeah, you know, some of the principles, the first books that were published, you know, right just after World War II. So previous to that, everybody was hunting with these old decoys. But as the pieces aged and the hunters became aged and the collecting of the aspect got introduced, it really picked up steam in the 60s and 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like I said, in the early 1980s, a number of books have been written. And then the more specific books that have really dovetailed everything have been in the last 10, 15 years. So that, in that sense, it hasn't been collected a long time. And that's one of the financial sides of it, is because all the interest has come into it in the last 20 years, the values on the items have escalated pretty rapidly, pretty recently.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that got some of the crossover interest in the collecting area as people saw the financial rise in the value of decoys, so that it began to pique interest in other areas.
Yeah, I remember there was a folk art collector that paid an enormous amount of money for a decoy that didn't collect decoys at all. So there's all the folk art aspect of decoys that people want to collect sometimes. But
yep.
getting back to that's
right, that's been a click comment made in the collecting area, you know, for the past 5 or 6 years or so at least.
Mm-hmm.
Is the crossover to the antique genre collector who wants a nice decoy or two, or the folk art collector who wants a nice decoy or two. And I think actually one of the higher-end birds that Gary mentioned was a piece that went to a folk art collector in terms of value. And
I think that's right. I think that's what I remembered also.
Rarity and stuff.
Yeah,
I mean, we had a number of key collections sell over the years. The last one was the McCleary sale that Guyette Schmidt co-hosted with Sotheby's. And the family for Dr. McCleary from Texas, he had a world-class collection, you know, the best of the best. If you buy that catalog, I think it's still reprinted. It's a great reference source because he had the best in the different fields. And it's the perfect model collection, and everybody used to look at it. Whereas some of the other collectors are more wide-ranging in what they have in terms of quality and stuff. He really focused in for the time period that he collected.
So let me just ask you this.
By pulling Sotheby's in, there was a direct appeal to the antique and folk art community.
Yep. Let me just ask you this. Before, just a few minutes ago, you mentioned that the working decoy was, you know, people weren't collecting it, they were using it. Well, what about the ones that were carved as decorative?
Yep. There's a lot of different areas. There's the decorative carvings. Those were around, and people would buy those. And, you know, when the decorative pieces were done by the Krolls, by the George Boyds, or whoever, those were not that very expensive at the time that they were carved in the 20s and 30s, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only when those carvers passed away and many years later, people say, well, I'll collect those decorative pieces or miniatures. There's also miniatures.
Right.
That people carved, which were, you know, very subscale, one-tenth scale sometimes.
Yes, I had some at auction one time that went for quite a bit of money. Who's the one that was popular in Massachusetts, I think it was?
Massachusetts was Kroll. Kroll on Cape Cod
did
a number
right.
of miniatures. He actually did a series of 75 miniatures, and you could collect the whole series. And every once in a while today, we'll see a whole series of those come up and sell. French, that Mr. French that Gary mentioned is selling their collection coming up in the spring of 2010 had a large number of miniatures in his collection. So that's going to be fascinating to see those come on the market. But Kroll on Cape Cod did 25 songbirds. He did 25 working ducks in his series, you know. And there were a number of other carvers who did small pieces. George Boyd from Seabrook, who passed away in the 1940s, he did a number of small carvings. And these were resold at the time through Ivor Johnson and Abercrombie and Fitch.
Oh, is that right?
Boston. And so they got spread out around the United States. So, you know, some people just collect miniature species and try and get the complete line, you know?
Wow. Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah. And they can go for several thousand dollars. And miniatures by Kroll, depending upon which era they are, you know, he carved in three different eras, and the bottom stamps on them tell you somewhat when they were carved and the paint quality. But those, you know, $2,000 to $3,000 to $4,000 to $5,000 each. So, you know.
That makes sense, because the two that I had was probably about 15 years ago, and I think they brought something like $2,000 or $3,000 for the two of them.
Yep.
So it probably was Kroll.
In my blue wing species collection that I have right now, I have about 45 birds of the early factory, so you can call that a larger or small size. You know, they range in value from several thousand up to about $10,000 to $15,000 for some of the high end ones. But I have mini blue wings and green wings in my collection to, you know, spice up the display a little bit.
Do you ever think you'll collect a different type of species and region, or is this something you think you'll just stay collecting?
Well, again, it's a function of money and how big a collection I want to get. I have purchased pieces outside of what I collect as a core collection, but I may not keep them all the time. I have pieces right now that are very folky that my wife likes, you know, like a merganser, which is just a swimming bird, a fishing bird.
Yeah, they have the funny head, right?
Yep. The different carvers would add different accents for the comb of the back of the head, you know, from hair to carving to just paint quality and stuff.
Yeah. Are there the contemporary carvers? I'm going to have a carver come up here, and he's going to be our next phone guest. But what can you tell me about contemporary carvers when it comes to decoys?
Well, like I said, there's a certain amount of known decoys. So the contemporary carver now is able to add decoys into the field for some of the lower end people to invest if they want a representative piece, but they can't afford the real one. You know, there's a crossover there. Some people call them replicas. But not everybody who's a contemporary carver is a replica carver. Mark McNair, you know, may carve in certain styles of other known carvers, but his pieces, you know, are really fine woodworking items. And so part of the value there is the fact of, you know, his skill and ability and presentation of the pieces also. But in general, the hardcore decoy collector, you know, he'll like a Mark McNair and a Ward, who's another carver down in Massachusetts, and there's a couple different guys around the United States. But there's numerous other people that just reproduce old styles, and some of the hardcore collectors really don't like that sometimes, you know what I mean?
I see.
They think it dilutes the money and the hobby somewhat, maybe, I'm not sure.
I talked to Gary a little bit about fakes and that. I thought it was very interesting because it seems like something very, very difficult to fake. And, you know, he did mention that there are telltales. Say what you're collecting. I'm sure you know every single thing about that type of duck. And if someone tried to pull off a fake, you'd probably recognize it right away.
Yeah, that's true. You know, you get to learn the different carvers. You get to see their style. And then you see somebody who's trying to imitate a certain style, and you see the paint's not quite right, or there's a slight newness to it, or whatever. And some of these reproductions do work into the hobby. Obviously, you know, they get sold, and they make it sold several times over, and then they enter, and somebody thinks they're an antique, and they're not. But you're right. If the specialist in their areas can usually spot those. A lot of the new collectors who have a financial commitment to decoys also hire brokers and traders to assist them in their collecting.
Is that right? Wow.
And these brokers and traders who come in and do this, it's just like the art field somewhat. They'll do it for a fee, but they'll also help them set up their collections so that they're accurate, they're good pieces. There's no question to the authenticity of the item and stuff. So Gary's right. If like, once again, if you're not a closet collector and you open up and you exchange information with other collectors, the bad pieces will get weeded out pretty quick.
Yeah. Now, going back to the Bourne catalogs out on the Cape, I wonder where he got all his information, or was it just regional birds that he was selling, so that's how he had all the information to begin with?
No, oftentimes he was also selling old collections, and the collectors would tell him, you know, what some of the pieces were, or if the collector had passed away, may have notes in his, you know, collecting files that told what some of the pieces were. I'm sure a lot of his knowledge was also from some of the local collectors,
mm-hmm.
maybe assisting him in cataloging, and then his own knowledge, you know. But mm-hmm. the early Bourne catalogs, a lot of what is known today was not known when those catalogs were released.
Right. So I imagine so. Mm-hmm.
The research and the data and the some of the questions and has been answered slowly over time. But he was, you know, some of the pioneers in it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you amassed this this library. Again, we had talked about Civil War. You had, I think you said you had like 2,000 books or more. So is it basically just catalogs, or are there books you recommend if someone is starting to collect?
No, well, I pay attention to the current catalogs for the current auction companies. I subscribe to their catalogs for, the, like I said, there's two or three or four key players who have current auctions every, you know, few months, three or four times a year that each of them may do it, or a couple times. So I'll get their catalogs and I'll see what's coming on the market now. If there was an old collection that was sold many years ago, I'll try and track down the catalog. Some of them are reprinted. Some of them pop up on eBay. You can buy the old catalogs and see the items when they're traded. But also, I get the books. You just have to pay attention. The books, you know, really, some of the books that have been published in the past 20 years are region-specific and stuff, and it's all good background data to look through. And
yeah.
Then it's also, it's just like in the Civil War area, I told you, exchanges with other collectors.
Sure.
Getting to meet other guys and hands-on real birds, you know, see some of the real things that you may not see all the time.
Now, do you attend any of the shows?
I do. I've set up a couple of my displays at some of the shows. I did a Portland show up here, actually Gary mentioned that they'll be coming to the Portsmouth, New Hampshire region in 2010,
right. Mm-hmm.
So I'll probably do a display there also. I've done the Maryland show once, but not the display.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Where would someone find you? What's your website?
The website is cottlehill.com, cottlehill.com.
And you actually have a few birds up there for sale, right?
I have a few birds up for sale, and I have a picture of some of the birds out of my collection. I don't have a complete posting up there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm lucky in this region here that some of the auction houses are from around here. There's a big auction house in Boston, so I can go down and preview their collections. I can preview a collection on Long Island. But I also have a friend, Russ Goldberger, who's a national decoy and antique guy. He lives in Rye, New Hampshire.
Yes.
Jim Cullen, who catalogs for Ron Bougeau, lives in Rye, New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
He just published a book on George Boyd, who was a famous New Hampshire carver from Seabrook. I wrote a small article on blue-winged teals that Russ actually has posted in an education section he has on his webpage.
Mm-hmm.
He's RJG Antiques. You can Google him. And he has information available that talk about collecting themes and everything on his site. He actually adds PR and media pieces to help the new collectors also.
You know, Jim Cullen was the person that bought my miniature decoys I had.
There you go.
Yeah, he's a good guy. He's brilliant, actually.
Jim's very smart. He's retired now, so
right?
He's doing a little bit of cataloging. He just published this very fine book. It was the first comprehensive review of George Boyd, who was a famous
one
of the principal New Hampshire carvers.
Right. Mm-hmm.
New Hampshire has a very limited shoreline. You know, we're only like
10 miles or
long.
Something. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know. I had a pair of Boyd ducks one time. I think they went for somewhere around $10,000 for the pair a number of years ago.
Yeah.
So very collectible. I'm pretty sure.
Well, you remember Wynn Carter from Portsmouth?
Oh yes.
He had mm-hmm. a big Boyd collection also.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah.
Yep.
Wow. So you're in Kittery, Maine, the southern part of Maine,
yep.
and you're right in the mix of right along the shoreline there, where there was a lot of duck hunting going on.
Yeah, and people always ask me, well, why do I collect Midwest factory birds? Why don't I collect Maine birds? Because they're about three or four, big carvers who were from Maine.
Yeah.
It's just I got out into a different area collecting before I realized that maybe I should have focused at home here. But it's all what you like to, you know, collect.
Sure. You can always change.
Yep, that's right. That's right.
So just before you leave, why don't you name, are you familiar with a couple of Maine carvers?
Yeah, Maine carvers, like I said, New Hampshire, you get into Massachusetts and North Shore, Mass, South Shore, Cape Cod, Nantucket, there's a ton of carvers. But
right.
In New Hampshire, there's one, George Boyd. He passed away in the 1940s. He was from Seabrook. He did a number of miniatures and full-size. In Maine, the principal carvers that are known are Gus Wilson,
right,
who was a lighthouse keeper, Monhegan Island, South Portland carver. He passed away, I'm not sure when, back in the 60s, I think. He has a number of fawns. Oz Bibber, Orlando Bibber,
mm-hmm,
passed away in 1970, was very popular. William Ross, Chappeague Island, you know, passed away in the 1950s. And then George Huey from Friendship, Maine. You know, these are all coastal regions.
Mm-hmm.
He was a famous carver, Sir George Huey. And a lot of, you know, like I say, regionally there's carvers, but also specifically there's species. So we tend to see a lot of old squat species, golden eyes, whistlers, sea ducks, and mergansers up here.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Those are the principal species that we see that are carved by those carvers that I mentioned. But George Boyd really did a cross-section. Even outside of the region, he carved also.
Now, there was a factory up in Maine where you see that the real rough surface. You see it everywhere. Freeport Dock, right? Am I getting that right?
There is. There's a number of carvers that you see that look like a rough decoy. There
yeah.
were some down in Texas and Mississippi also.
Oh, really? That looked like a Freeport?
Yep. Yep.
Huh, how about that?
Yep. There's also, it's all it is just a rough lathe bit because the bodies on a lot of these decoys, once they moved to a factory production era, they were done on lathe.
Mm-hmm.
So those rough ones sometimes are it's lathe marks from spinning. It's just not really refined in production.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess from a duck's perspective, it looks okay. You know,
that's right.
Flying in, that worked good enough, huh?
Some people say it mimics feathers. So.
Yeah. That's a cop-out, actually, right?
Yep. Sure.
All right, John. Well, you've been great. Your knowledge is in many fields. I wonder what you're going to start collecting after decoys. You already did the Civil War and decoys.
My wife is scared with that same question.
I bet she is. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I've been to your house. You have some room, but you can only collect so much, you know?
That's right. Yeah.
All right. Well, very good. Thank you very much, John.
Thank you, Martin. I enjoyed it again. Good luck and good success with everything.
All right. Take care. Yeah. Okay, next we have on the line is a carver that his name keeps coming up as a noted contemporary carver, and he's out of Virginia, Mark McNair. Hey, Mark, how you doing?
I'm doing very well. And you?
It's pretty good. How's the temperature down there in Virginia today?
Grown up in Connecticut, I have to say that this would be a mild day. Probably, I don't know, in the 30s, but after the last few days, it feels quite pleasant.
Uh-huh.
Stops nice and warm, the sun's coming through the window, and glad to be here.
Great, great. Well, first of all, how long have you been carving?
Well, I started in the summer of 1972, and fiddled with it a little bit in those last waning months of 72, but by 73 I was getting pretty serious about spending a lot of time doing this, but still no vision that I would be doing it even 5 years from now, or then, and
mm-hmm.
you know, let alone now, so I guess you'd have to do the math. What is that? So
that's
wow, 38 years.
It's a long time. Now,
lifetime.
Yeah, yeah. Now, what steered you toward carving decoys?
Well, I'd started in college thinking I was going to be an architect. I loved to paint. I've been painting my whole life. I painted portraits and things like that, and I kind of fancied myself doing something like that. But I ended up living in this lovely home in Old Lyme, Connecticut, and the people that lived there, the family had grown up and moved away. I was sort of like a surrogate son. They were all painters and sculptors, and there were just a lot of really interesting, intriguing things in that home, and one of them was a merganser decoy, and it was quite unique. I didn't understand it, but I knew there was something interesting about it, and people commented about that merganser. They said, this is a wonderful example of a piece of American folk art. And I was just turned 22, and a lot of this was, you know, the whole world is new to you then.
Mm.
And I was interested in Eskimo art and Northwest Coast Indian art. And again, all of this is just beginning. And there was something about this merganser that I found intriguing. This fellow named Chris Voorhees, who had grown up there, he was a carver, and he had just shown up from Colorado and brought some goose decoy that he had just carved. And there was a fellow named Timmy Eastland, and he was just starting to collect decoys, and he was really into antiques, and it was just a conversation that was going on, and it just all clicked one night, and I really felt like I got it,
mm.
in the sense that I got it. This is something where I want to explore.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have all the answers, but I knew I wanted to explore this. And that's how it all began. And I carved a merganser decoy based on that one that was sitting up on the mantle. And then pretty much immediately when I made the second one, I changed it. I turned the head around 180 degrees. So I think that sort of says something about my attitude about this from the very, very beginning. You see something, you're stimulated, and then I want to change it and make it my own. Really the beginning.
Do you happen to have that decoy still?
No, I don't. I was stunned that Timmy expressed a real interest in it, and everybody was kind of marveling that I had done this, you know, bam, just like that, out of the gate. Timmy had a pair of hinges, early 18th century hinges, that I kind of fancied, and so I swapped them for the hinges. I still have the hinges, but I swapped the decoy. I had a chance to buy it back a couple of times, and it's still out there. Someplace.
Uh-huh.
And you know, it was mine at one time, and you know, that's, as an artist, I can say that's enough of ownership.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, do you study old designs, or I spoke with someone earlier, John Ackerbloom, and he said that a lot of the designs are your own. But do you study other designs as well, the old ones?
Oh yeah. This, you know, none of this happened in a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
I think I said before that I had become interested in Eskimo art and
yes.
Northwest Coast art. I like African masks in
mm-hmm.
particular, and headpieces and all. I like how cultures distill an identity into their tribal work, their cultural work.
Right.
And over periods of hundreds of years or thousands of years, now you can see that in the Greeks, how they looked at things that were Egyptian, which were a much higher form than theirs, and then by using that as a beginning, they developed their own distinctive art form,
mm-hmm.
Which we consider classic today. I know maybe I'm spinning this off a little bit more, but yeah, everything is connected to something else, and so a trip to a museum, a trip to a collection, looking at birds in the field, I never really know where the inspiration is going to come from, but I learned by looking at the old decoys. In the same
sure.
way, if you were going to be a boat builder,
mm-hmm.
you wouldn't design it from scratch. You'd look at old boats and you'd build things that, you know, that suited your fancy, or and then incorporate that and then make your own changes if that suited your mood.
Sure. Now you're in you're in Virginia. How do you say the name of the town you're in? Because I see it on the internet.
Yeah, I live in Craddockville.
Craddockville, right?
Little village on. What's called the Eastern Shore of Virginia. We make up the lower Chesapeake Bay.
Mm-hmm.
It's south of the island of Chincoteague. It's not far from Cobb Island. As the crow flies, it's a bit of a trip crossing the water. But I'm in an area that had an awful lot of decoy and boat building heritage.
Sure.
You know, in the last century.
Do you collect, I know Virginia had some great carvers, do you collect any old decoys?
You know, I have a few. I collected things a long time ago. They were very inexpensive, and I didn't have a house or a wife and children or things like that. And you could buy really terrific examples for, you know, $25-$30. So,
mm-hmm.
And it was easy to find things. So I did collect things then. And over the years, I've kind of winnowed down a little bit. And but, yeah, there's decoys throughout the house.
I
have probably, you know, a couple of dozen and maybe a few dozen of my own.
Now, I looked at a lot of the images of your work, and it's very nice. Now, you mentioned earlier that you were a painter as well, so I'm sure you do all the detail work yourself, or does someone else help you with that?
No, I do it all myself, and that's a very common question. It always takes me a bit by surprise, but I've gotten used to it. I can't quite, for me personally, I can't conceive of it any other way. You know, the Ward brothers, Lem did the painting, Steve did the carving. And, you know, what a beautiful matchup that was. But for me, it is very much, it's all the same. There's a lot of decoys that I make that I don't paint because I feel that they're finished when the carving is done. When you're carving, you're really creating a canvas on which you're going to apply, you know, a two-dimensional polychromed finish, you know, on this three-dimensional surface. So I'm really drawing the whole time. I use a pencil as much as I use, you know, knife edges and things like that.
Wow.
Constantly sculpt with that, laying on the patterns where the paint is going to go. So to me, the two of them are inexorably linked.
I see. Wow.
I shouldn't say it's a funny question. It's a very logical question for somebody to ask, because the two can seem so separated, but for me, it's they're fully integrated and almost one and the same.
But you just said earlier that sometimes you do a carving and it's done. You don't paint it?
Yeah.
Now,
that's something that you acquire a sense for. It's part of a maturing process as an artist, to know when something is done.
Yeah, I understand. I paint as well, and sometimes it's taken me a long time to figure out when to just stop, you know, when I'm doing the work.
Now, that also gives you the license to go back and change something a week later, 6 months later. You can go, if something isn't right, you can go back and alter it. It's it's a living piece, you know, works in progress. I have a friend who was a wonderful playwright, and he tweaked his plays throughout his life.
Wow.
Things that he had, you know, 60 years later, he would go back and he would change the order of some words because they get a clearer meaning out of it.
Wow.
Again, I think it's part of the maturing process as an artist.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, you know, it's funny you say that. I've looked at paintings that I did back in 1998, and I start to pick up the brush to do something, and then I stop myself, and I say, nope, you know, that was then, and, you know, just do what you do now.
Yeah, there's a little bit of everything in all of this. You know, I've heard that Leonardo painted the Mona Lisa for many years, carrying it around with him. if that's what he needed to do, well, then...
It worked.
It worked, yeah.
Now, are your pieces strictly decorative decoys, or do you carve working decoys as well?
Well, you know, I live in an interesting time. If I lived 100 years ago, I think they would all have ended up in the water. I do carve working decoys. Everything that I make, you can take out and hunt. So if the lights go out tomorrow, we can always go out hunting. And that's very true. It never dawned on me to do anything other than that. I every once in a while I make something whimsical, but even if I make a weather vane, I want it to function. You know, the idea of being a boat builder and building salad bars for Red Lobster or something like that just doesn't appeal to me. But it always seemed like that is the touchstone of what I'm doing, that it is a real decoy. It's made to function, whether it's hollow or solid. I use brass fittings or galvanized fittings or oak or locust pegs and things like that to hold things together, paint things with oil. I weight things. I throw almost everything overboard because I want to see what it looks like.
Really?
And I've made quite a few birds that actually do get used. I've got a friend up the road that I hunt with, and he's got a dozen black ducks and mallards, and Tommy O'Connor must have, 40, 50 of my pieces that he hunts over. And right now, in this is just purely serendipity, I'm making a turkey decoy. I've never made one before, but I'm making a turkey decoy for a friend of mine, and he is very anxious to use it, and so I'm designing it purely to go into the field, although
really?
I imagine he'll probably store it in his living room in the off-season. In all honesty, most of my decoys do end up in collections on shelves, and the situation is such that they are too valuable to, mm-hmm. you know, monetarily, which is not something I created. That's just the way it is. But they're too valuable to put in the water.
Well, let's talk about value.
Sure.
I know an old acquaintance of mine, Steve O'Brien, had an auction in Boston, and I was reading the press release. You had some record pieces. Let's go over some of those records.
Sure, yeah.
I know there was a grouping of five, is that right?
Yeah.
And what it, can you explain what that was?
Yeah, I grew up in New England. I've lived half my life here in Virginia, but I grew up in New England, and I just have New England sensibilities and that Protestant work ethic and the New England craftsmanship rubbed off on me. I think I got a lot of that from my dad. He was a really good woodworker. Really, I shouldn't say good. He was a fine woodworker and carpenter and had a very good eye, although I don't think he ever gave himself much credit for it. Anyhow, what the connection with all of that is, I really love really fine New England boats and and architecture and furniture. And the decoys of New England tend to be very refined, beautifully done, and places like Nantucket, they made exquisite decoys. And I suppose it has something to do with there were so many shipbuilders out there that these shipwrights had such woodworking skills that it was quite easy for them to build beautiful hollow decoys, you know, dovetail joinery for the heads, lovely paint jobs. They sailed the world, so they had things like, you know, baleen and whalebone for bills, exotic woods that they would have been used for blocks and cleats on boats and all. And you find these all integrated into these shorebirds.
Really?
And they're just really, really, really lovely. Very easy to identify a shorebird from Nantucket and also from Cape Cod and that area in there. Anyhow, I've just always considered them to be extremely sweet and lovely. I'd been to visit Doc Starr many years ago from Duxbury, Mass., and he had some just gorgeous shorebirds. And when you see something that's really wonderful, it sort of sets a standard for you. I'd also been to visit Joe French. He was an old collector and had a wonderful collection of shorebirds. So I had this kind of gold standard to work from. And so when I was making these golden plovers, which is a bird that really just shows up on Nantucket and the Cape, I naturally hollowed them, and I probably used ebony for the bills, and I really laid on a really sweet paint job because I wanted to do something that was in keeping with that style. And so why there was a group that was made together, this was had to do with a man in New York who was a patron of mine for 30 years. And after I had made him a pair, he said, "I would love it if you would make a group for me." And I don't like to do orders, and I don't like to do things, you know, because I'm into something else by the time I finish something. But we had a very, very special relationship, and this was kind of a request and a challenge, and I was actually thinking about it. So I made this rig, and he had them exhibited in his living room, and he passed away a few years ago. That's how they happened to go to auction. And I think it's really wonderful that the family decided to keep them together, and also that Steve had the foresight to keep them together because, you know, once they break them up, you know, they'll never get back. So that was the story behind that. And I think Steve was right in what he did, and I think that showed in the auction price, which was quite a surprise to all of us.
And the price was?
It was made in 1989. It was the five Nantucket-style golden plovers, and it sold for $37,375.
Wow. So you were actually in the audience and saw this happen. That's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. And my son was there, too. He's working for Steve now. So that was pretty sweet for all of us.
Oh, wow. And then there were some other records for single birds that was surprisingly high. One was 16. Is that right?
Yeah. There was a pair of swans that I had also made for Barry. And one of them was for him, and I think the other one was, he asked me if I would make a mate. He loved to have mates. And he asked me if I would make this for his wife. And Barry was also one of these guys that always got me to sign everything, not just with my name, but something special. And we did have a kind of relationship. And, yeah, one of the swans brought, I think it was somewhere around 10 or 12. And then right after that, the second one brought, it was just something north of 16,000.
Wow. Now, speaking of signing, do you sign all your work or just some of your work?
Yeah. You know, in the very, very beginning, I was looking at old decoys. And if you, look at the bottom of old decoys, most of them aren't signed. You know, it was just anonymous work. They were tools of the trade, and they were, work done by artisans.
Uh-huh.
I think probably a better description. They certainly hadn't been elevated to art, or even folk art at the time. Nobody really knows where they are in the moment. You know, it's only looking back that you see this. Fortunately, being a painter, I did sign paintings when I did finish something, or I was painting signs at the time, and I would put my signature down in the bottom. So I was carving my initials in the bottom, or an M, or something like that. In the beginning, I didn't realize how important it was, but I met George Ross Starr, Doc Starr, who we refer to him as, and I went to visit him with Tim Eastland, and I showed him one of my birds, and he flipped it over, and he said, "There's no signature."
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "No." And he goes, "Well, it should be signed." And I said, "Gee, Doc, most birds aren't signed." He goes, "No," he says, "it's very important that you should do this," he said, "because if people like this and they want to collect this, people will want to know in 50 years from now or 100 years from now who made it and when."
Mm-hmm.
And he showed me some birds that were signed, and it made a real impression on me, and I've signed them since then. And, it keeps things honest, too, which is a...
Sure. What percentage of shorebirds do you do compared to waterfowl?
Probably overall, over these last 39 years, it's probably about 50-50.
Mm-hmm.
But in the last 10 years, I would say it's far more shorebirds. I can't explain why, other than that is just the way I've just followed my bliss, that I really like making them. That's just the way it's worked out.
Sure.
It wasn't anything deliberate. But I could probably just spend the rest of my life making shorebirds. But that's not the case. Obviously, I'm making a turkey right now, and making some mergansers. And when I come out to the shop in the morning, I've usually got a pretty clear idea of what I want to do that day, and it's usually connected with something I have been thinking about. And then today I feel compelled to do it. So it goes back and forth. But I'd say probably in the last 10 years, it's probably been more like, oh, golly, I don't know, maybe 60-70% have been shorebirds.
Uh-huh. Now, what type, do you use the same type of wood in all, I know you talked earlier about using mixed wood, but for the most part, do you use the same, like a single type of wood?
Yeah, the bodies, it's best to, like, especially with shorebirds, it's best to separate the woods, because the bills are made out of a hardwood, and you can use oak, locust, you can use bone, rosewood, ebony, things like that, depending on the style of piece that you're making. But the bodies, for the most part, are made out of either Atlantic white cedar or northern white cedar. These are both wonderful boat-building woods. And then lately, I've gotten into using some very nice old white pine that had been barns up in Pennsylvania. And a friend of mine got me some beams, and this stuff is great. It's just got a beautiful color, and it's like carving a big chunk of butter.
Wow.
So those are the three woods that you use for bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the bills and any kind of pinning you might do would be a hardwood.
Mm-hmm. Now, how do you actually sell your decoys? Do you have someone represent you, or what?
Well, it's a little bit of both. When I first started, I sold some to my friend Tim Eastland, and then he introduced me to a couple of people that liked decoys. I didn't know there was a decoy world out there, people that actually collected. I had never heard of a decoy show. This is going back to the
early
70s. They just had the Mackey auctions up in Bourne, the Bourne's auction up on the Cape.
Sure.
And so people in the antique world, were kind of a buzz with that. And then somebody told me about a decoy show. And Tim and I went off to one on Long Island, and we had a great time and got a wonderful reception. And I sold all of these decoys, which I used to carry around in a wooden fish box in the back of my car. And that was a heck of a thrill. And So I started going to decoy shows, and that's where I met most of these people and my customers, patrons, and all. And that was pretty much my outlet for years. And then as the relationships developed, it became more one-on-one, you know, through letters, telephone calls, visits, and things like that, and a little less relying on shows. I go to shows now for the social part of it, but it doesn't have much to do with my actual selling. But bringing it up to the last few years, I developed a relationship with Steve O'Brien in Boston, and he has been selling things. I've been selling things through him and his gallery. And the other person is Burton Moore at the Audubon Gallery in Charleston, in South Carolina. And they have a show down there. Well, he has a gallery year-round, but they have a show in February. And both my sons went to school there. And we went down to visit during the show and to visit the boys and just had a great time hanging out at the gallery. And I had brought some birds and found that they sold, and it was a new market, and it was just met some really wonderful people. And so now I'm working with Burton Moore as well, and it's a beautiful gallery, and it's a great feeling to walk in and see your birds,
and Audubon,
you know, Havel print behind it, and it's humbling and a great honor. So.
Now, did any of your sons take up carving?
Yeah, and they're both really good.
Oh, is that right? Is one named Ian?
Yes.
Okay, then I saw one of his birds on the internet. Nice.
Yeah, he's the oldest, and he started carving literally when he was probably, I don't know, maybe three and a half. I mean, he wasn't making working decoys, but he could use a spoke shave, which he called a poke tave, and he could really make. He used to call them curlies, and he could really carve. But he started making some things when he was probably about five, actually constructing things. And Colin was the same way. And they're both very skillful. It's something that, you know, I didn't make them do. They just liked it. They like working with wood. They both can paint very well. They both have their own style. You can see it connected to mine. But they both have a sense of imagination, and it's really great.
Yeah, that's a thrill. Now, do you have a website?
No, I don't. I've actually got some business cards that have my address from old Lyme from 30-something years ago. And I've never printed any new ones. No, I guess, and I say this slightly tongue-in-cheek, I'm probably more of an 18th century person than a 21st, and I'm skipping over the 19th century because of the industrial age. I really like working with hand tools. I like the meditative effect of all of that. And I think a website, maybe it's not a bad idea. Maybe it's just sort of a presentation of things. But as far as a communication point, for taking orders or this is what I have for sale, I don't think it would fit my style. I have a wonderful working relationship with an awful lot of really fabulous people that have been, you know, great friends, great supporters, great patrons.
You're the type of person that lets the money chase the art instead of the art chase the money. And I think that's it's almost a dying breed. It's really very interesting to talk to you. And you know,
I guess I had a lot of good influences early in life, and was wise enough to listen.
Well, this has been really great. I've really enjoyed speaking with you, and it was really nice to learn about you.
I did too. Well, thank you very much.
It was very interesting. All right. Well, you take care, and I'll talk to you soon, Mark.
Okay. Right. You too. Thanks again. Bye bye.
All right. Bye bye. Wow, Mark McNair. I like that guy. Thank you for listening. And also, remember, if you are looking to buy something on Amazon.com, you can search through our website. And if you buy something, we'll get a small fee that will help us carry on. We hope you enjoyed the show today, and thanks for listening. This is Martin Willis, signing off.